From Mississippi to Pennsylvania, Missouri to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the recent COP28 climate conference was full of pageantry and posturing, but produced little of practical value. Henry Snyder from the Competitive Enterprise Institute has analysis. Former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy will resign from Congress at the end of this month. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story on the impact. The COVID-19 pandemic is over, but the discovery of more and more fraud related to COVID programs continues to grow. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And it was a day that will indeed live in infamy. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA visited Pearl Harbor last week and shares his thoughts on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The COP28 Climate Conference produced more big government policy recommendations, but achieved little of substance. Henry Snyder is a professor of economics at the Nord Academy near Hamburg, Germany, and he provides policy analysis for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He has represented his native Switzerland at past conferences, and he joins us now to talk about this year's event. Henry, welcome to American Radio Journal. Henry, when we look at the climate conference, tell us what it is, officially known as COP28. For somebody who's never heard of this, what does that even mean?
Actually, that's bureaucratic lingo. COP means Conference of Parties. A party is a country that is part of a larger international agreement. So the Conference of Parties is a conference of countries that are part of this climate agreement under the United Nations. The number 28 just says it's the 28th time that these countries are meeting to discuss the further development of that agreement.
So as usual, one of the outcomes of this conference, Henry, has been a lot of continued climate hysteria. You've actually written, and this is one of your quotes, and I'd like you to expand upon it a bit. You said that this predictable pageantry still poses genuine costs in the form of harmful government intervention and wealth transfers. Policymakers should reject the idea that more government and more spending are solutions. So a lot of pageantry. What do you make of all that?
Let me begin by the pageantry, because that's the most juicy detail of it all. As I told you, COP is a bureaucratic thing. It's just a bunch of bureaucrats coming together, developing some international agreement. However, for some reason, some bizarre reason, it's turned into a circus where press, the media, and observers go. This year, we have apparently over 40,000 people observing the bureaucrats negotiating. This is incredible. This is just a bureaucratic process. I'm not saying that the bureaucrats are always good or right or whatever, but let them do their job. You don't need 40,000 people to observe how someone is negotiating details of a bureaucratic agreement. And that's what I mean with pageantry. We always make such a fuss out of it as if the world will be on the line and everyone there will be there trying to save the world. It's not true. It's just a way that international negotiations works. Countries come together, discuss things, and then eventually they come up with a drafting document at the end saying some very nice things. Now, this is the pageantry part. There is a thing where we as taxpayers should be very concerned, which is that whenever you have such a media circus, some countries are very good in using it for their own purposes. And in these climate conferences, the developing countries, those countries like China, who like to be counted as developing, India, Brazil, South Africa, these countries, they gang up and try to force developed countries such as the U.S. or my native Switzerland into transferring wealth. It means paying money, taxpayer money, for their, Brazil's, China's development. So we would be financing their development based on some very loosely thing related to climate.
When we look at this issue of man-made climate change here, Professor, without being accused of being a climate change denier, I mean, we all know that the climate is warming, but is that really something that is happening naturally and can be addressed by all of this bureaucratic negotiations that you're talking about?
Listen, I have no idea, and I don't take a position whether it's happening or not happening, where it's happening naturally or whether it's man-made or anything like that. I really don't care that much about it. What I care about, and often I was tasked with negotiating parts of this agreement for my native Switzerland, is can we do anything about it? And bureaucracy cannot do anything about it. If there is climate change, the solution will be technology, will not be different international treaties with a lot of government intervention. If I may, I want to expand on that. If you look at these climate negotiations, there are two things. So-called mitigation, so how to reduce emissions leading to climate change, and adaptation, how to live with climate change. And most countries are interested in the second part, how to live with climate change. Why? Because they see it as a way that developed countries like the U.S. pay for developing countries to have a very nice life without having to bear the cost of reducing emissions. And this doesn't help the climate. If there is climate change, just paying for people to live with climate change doesn't change climate change. So the Conference of Parties at the end is not addressing the very issue on which it's based, which would be to mitigate any damaging activities that we have leading to climate change. They don't do it. They try to transfer money in order for people to live with climate change. And that kind of defeats the purpose.
Among the writings that you have done, and we're going to give folks some information where they can access those writings here very shortly, one of the things you said in conclusion was, when it comes to the solution, that we should recognize removing government obstacles, clearly defining private property rights, and defending economic freedom will lead to better environmental outcomes and human flourishing. Could you expand upon that a little bit?
I think that if climate change is such a big issue, then what we should do is actually make people think about how to solve it. And how do you make people think about how to solve it? You give them a carrot by making it possible to make a profit on solving climate change. Making a profit, that's a market mechanism. You need market signals. You need freedom. You need the special entrepreneurialism to solve the problem, if there is a problem to be solved in this case. And how do you make people turn into entrepreneurs? How do you make them compete with their ideas? You just remove barriers to international trade. You remove barriers to the development and deployment of new technology. You basically give them freedom to try out the things that might lead to the solution. That's how we manage everything until now in the history of mankind. Let's look back. How did we manage to escape hunger? We found out chemicals that makes land better, so fertilizers. How did we manage to escape poverty problems? We found out ways to employ people, industrialization. And I'm sure that if climate change is a problem, people will come up with some technological, entrepreneurial idea, and we need to give them freedom in order for that to work.
We have been talking with Henry Schneider, who is a professor of economics at the Nord Academy, that near Hamburg, Germany, but also is writing a number of policy papers for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Henry, where can folks go to find your writings on the COP28 and also the policy prescriptions that you have written for the Competitive Enterprise Institute?
It's on CEI.org. It's CEI.org. On the very front page, you have everything that you need to know about climate conferences. You have papers about how they work. And you also have a paper about the hot topics in this conference.
Henry Schneider with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Professor, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, and of course, he does keep an eye on everything that happens on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. for us, and a big week we've had this past week. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House, who was deposed a couple of months back, has announced he is resigning. What sort of impact is that going to have?
Well, it's a good question. You know, obviously, House Republicans, the entire Congress, starting last January, have dealt with this really, really slim majority. And Speaker McCarthy's decision to end his congressional career at the end of December sort of brings shockwaves to Washington for a few different reasons. Number one, a lot of people are concerned about having just a two-seat majority now. And we know that Bill Johnson from Ohio, who we've previously talked about in this show, he's going to be leaving in the springtime, which could bring it down to one. And all it takes is an unfortunate death of one of the older members of the House conference for it to be dead even, and you effectively lose your majority. And handing over unified government to Joe Biden in an election year could be quite dangerous. What would Speaker Hakeem Jeffries do, right? But on the other hand, McCarthy has been in Washington. He sort of rose to power fairly quickly on that 2010 red wave Tea Party movement. Even though he really wasn't a Tea Party type candidate, he was already in Congress, but they built the Young Guns program, him, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, all three of them are gone from Congress now. McCarthy served less than two full decades in Washington, but he accumulated the highest levels of power in Washington, being just two heartbeats away from the presidency and serving as the 55th Speaker of the House. McCarthy possibly is going to join the House Financial Services Committee chairman named Patrick McHenry, who also announced his retirement. They're obviously very close. When McCarthy was vacated from the speakership, he designated McHenry to be the Speaker pro tem and basically preside over the House while they resolve the differences in selecting Mike Johnson to be the next Speaker. But a McHenry-McCarthy team would be incredibly powerful as it pertains to the influences of lobbying and consulting in Washington, D.C. That's what a lot of people are presuming are the next steps for the two of them. McCarthy made money sort of being a sandwich shop guy. I think he won a lottery and used that as leverage to get into Congress. But he's not one of these big bankrolling, wealthy, Rockefeller type rich guys. And that being said, he's got his tentacles inserted into the highest levels of financial power in America. And so I do think that McCarthy will ultimately be just as successful in the private sector as he was in Congress and attaining all the power that he attained over really almost 17 years. That district in California is one of the brightest red districts of that state. And a lot of people like to talk about how California is a socialist pit of misery, but his district is a real opportunity for us to get a good conservative elected.
In the meantime, we are, of course, Scott, in the midst of the holiday season here, and folks are preparing for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever particular holiday they celebrate at this time of the year. Economically speaking, how are folks faring this holiday season?
I think that this holiday season, people really are feeling the increased costs of the Biden policies. And, you know, you can unpack the polling data from Gallup and the Associated Press and Pew and others and really start to see this broad consensus that Joe Biden's economy is wrecking the middle class. I think we've talked about the report from the Joint Economic Committee and how it's nearly a four-year cumulative cost of $50,000 for the average household. Well, the average household is only 2.6 people. So imagine if you're a family of four with two kids, or a family of six with four kids, or something even bigger. The decisions that you've got to make this Christmas season, not just surrounding what's going to be served on the table, but what you can afford for gifts, what debt you're willing to take on, did you receive a Christmas bonus, are you receiving a wage increase, all those things are a big, big part of Bidenomics. Ultimately, it's the age-old question that I think was really made popular during the Reagan administration. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And when people ask themselves that question in 2024, the answer is clear as the light of day, and it is that people are not better off today. They were better off in the Trump administration. They were better off even in the Obama years. Economically, people are struggling.
And of course, in 2024, we will continue to keep an eye on all things political and happening in Washington, D.C. with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is united in the ideas of free markets, economic freedom, economic liberty, and opportunity. The website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The federal government spent trillions of dollars during the COVID-19 pandemic, and the amount of fraud being revealed continues to climb. We turn now to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
A couple claiming to run a farm that employed dozens of people used fake employee records to get more than $1 million in COVID-19 relief payments when they actually employed no one on a farm that did not exist. A social media influencer created fake documents to score more than $400,000 in COVID-19 relief funds meant to help small businesses, then used the money to buy cryptocurrency and gifts for his girlfriend, naturally. And a state employee whose job it was to stop unemployment benefits fraud helped other fraudsters navigate around fraud prevention systems so they could steal more than $1 million, including federal tax dollars, made available to state unemployment systems during the pandemic. And those are just a few of the cases, a few of the ways in which COVID relief money was stolen or fraudulently given away during the pandemic. The true extent of COVID relief fraud will likely never be known. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking yet another look at the amount of money, the sheer insane volume of money that was stolen and wasted during the COVID-19 pandemic. This is a topic that I keep coming back to. I know probably something that I cover on almost a monthly basis here on American Radio Journal, but I think this is one of the most important and actually kind of underreported stories of the pandemic. One of the big lessons of the pandemic is exactly this, is that if you try to give away this much money, a lot of it, much of it is going to be stolen. And once it's gone, it's gone. Of course, there are other lessons from the pandemic too, arguably more important ones about like the social destructiveness of lockdown policies, about the absolute foolishness of trying to close playgrounds and outdoor public spaces when you're trying to contain a respiratory virus, debates about masking and vaccine policy. All of that contains important lessons in all of this. As an aside, I thought it was really amusing last week during the debate between Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and California Governor Gavin Newsom to hear Newsom try to pin the title of lockdown governor on DeSantis. Because, of course, DeSantis did close some public and private spaces in Florida at the start of the pandemic, but Florida was one of the first states to reopen, and it stayed open during subsequent COVID waves. That, of course, in stark contrast to what happened in Newsom's California. But I don't care so much about the specifics of that debate. I think I care more about the fact that you've got Newsom, a Democratic governor who was a cheerleader and an advocate and an activist of COVID lockdowns and aggressive COVID policies. He is now trying to use the term lockdown governor to attack DeSantis. And I think just the way that all went down says something about which side won that debate in the long run, right? The side of freedom and personal responsibility obviously won. So there are many important lessons to come out of the pandemic. But one of the big ones, as I said, is that if you're going to try to dump trillions of dollars into the economy in a very short period of time, a lot of that money is going to be stolen. And once it's gone, it's gone. It's not coming back. The latest data point in that unfortunate trend comes from a new Government Accountability Office report. Here's the way the Government Accountability Office puts it. Quote, when the federal government provides emergency assistance, the risk of payment errors, including those attributable to fraud, may increase because the need to provide this assistance quickly can lead agencies to relax or forego effective safeguards. Because not all fraud will be identified, investigated, and adjudicated through judicial or other systems, the full extent of fraud associated with COVID-19 relief funds will never be known with certainty. Reason Magazine, where I work, and I myself personally have, of course, reported quite a bit on the specifics of this fraud. Auditors believe that about $200 billion was fraudulently distributed from just two programs run by the Small Business Administration during the pandemic. That's about one-sixth of all the money that was run through those two programs, the Paycheck Protection Program and the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program. Additionally, the GAO believes that between $100 billion and $135 billion in federal unemployment funds, which were provided to states on a temporary basis during the pandemic, that amount of money, over $100 billion, was lost to fraud. One former U.S. attorney has called it the biggest fraud in a generation. It's far too late, of course, to put all of those horses back in the barn. The money is gone, but state and federal officials are trying to do what they can. The latest GAO report does detail some of those ongoing efforts, including the nearly 1,400 individuals who have been found guilty of fraud connected to COVID-19 relief efforts. As of June, the GAO reported there had been over 1,000 sentences handed down in those cases, often requiring restitution of fraudulent payments. Hundreds of people have been given jail time, including 33 who have received sentences of 10 years or more. But there are still another 500 cases pending in the court system, according to the GAO. Congress has extended the statute of limitations for COVID-related fraud to 10 years. So that's one good move, one step in the right direction, but I think it's a good bet that prosecutors will be adding to these numbers for a long time to come. And the Government Accountability Office told Reason last month that they don't have a running total at the moment for how much money has been recovered via all of these ongoing enforcement efforts. What has been reported, however, leaves a huge gap. For example, the GAO says that states have identified about $55.8 billion in fraudulent and non-fraudulent unemployment overpayments that occurred during the pandemic. Of that $55.8 billion, only about $6.8 billion have been recovered so far. Of course, none of those calculations include COVID aid that was lost to other types of wasteful spending, things that don't meet the legal standard for fraud. As we've also reported, much of the aid was delivered to cities and states that then turned around and blew it on frivolities like golf courses, minor league baseball stadiums, or padding the paychecks of public employees. For example, Iowa spent more than $12 million of its federal bailout on a new baseball stadium near the Field of Dreams movie set, and Michigan spent $25 million on a travel marketing campaign, as if those were vital pandemic-related issues. The federal and state officials who approved all of that spending won't be seeing the inside of a jail cell, even though I think the distinction between using COVID-19 aid to build a baseball stadium and using it to buy a luxury car for your girlfriend is mostly just about aesthetics. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this important issue, coverage of the debate this week, and everything else going on around the country at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The lesson of the attack on Pearl Harbor is that America must stay united in the face of atrocity. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
With apologies to Abraham Lincoln 82 years ago this week, our nation was the target of a surprise and brutal attack at Pearl Harbor. Just a few days ago, I had the occasion to visit Pearl Harbor and the USS Arizona Memorial for the first time. It was an incredibly moving experience. I knew the basic details of that fateful day, but being there and seeing it in person made the horror of it real in a way that no book or film can really convey. I will not forget standing on the Arizona Memorial itself, the sunken battleship easily visible beneath our feet, and thinking about the 1,177 who died on that one ship on December 7, 1941. Because the powder magazine was struck and burned with such intensity for 2 days, few of the bodies could be recovered. The Arizona itself, rather than military cemeteries, became the final resting place for approximately 1,000 of her crew of 1,731. But what I had never known until my recent visit is that 44 of the survivors, years later, began to request to be buried with their shipmates. And they were, the last one just 4 years ago. The one remaining survivor is 102, and he has said he will be buried with his family. I found myself thinking of those 44 who wanted to rejoin their fallen shipmates as much as I thought of the 1,177 who died. What an example of loyalty and camaraderie. I also found myself thinking about the lessons that we as a nation should learn from that disastrous day that claimed a total of 2,403 American lives. In the immediate aftermath of the attack, the phrase, "Remember Pearl Harbor," became an American mantra. Here we are now, 82 years later. What's the message of Pearl Harbor and the Arizona to America in the 21st century? Is it about the virtue of loyalty or the risk of unpreparedness? Two Pearl Harbor-scale attacks that occurred in this century are 9/11 and the Hamas attack on Israel. If we look at them all together, can we find a common theme and perhaps a common lesson? All three were surprise attacks, so naturally we ask if the targets were asleep at the switch, so to speak. And of course they were. But was there something that could have prevented the attacks? All three involved known antagonists who had bragged that some kind of attack was forthcoming. It is impractical to take preventive measures against every single boasted threat. Good intelligence can help sort through the threats and distinguish between those that are merely antagonistic bravado and those that have the capability as well as the intent to carry out a genuine attack. But intelligence failures occur. Witness Israeli intelligence's failure to predict, let alone prevent, the October 7th attacks by Hamas. It is classic armchair quarterbacking and not helpful to point fingers of blame after an attack while contributing little to reducing the likelihood of a recurrence. It is worth noting that all three attackers embraced a culture of death as a virtue. Their leaders managed to persuade their adherents to act en masse, not just as individuals detonating suicide vests among innocent civilians in a marketplace or on a bus. Is it possible that the clue to stopping these mass attacks lies not in trying to deduce the motivations of individual terrorists, such as hopelessness and despair, but rather the motivations of their leaders? In an article titled "The Culture of Death, Terrorist Organizations and Suicide," the congressionally chartered Wilson Center concluded that terrorist organizations will continue to be employed by groups as long as they are considered effective. Conversely, suicide terrorism will decline in incidence when the terrorist organizations conclude that it is not effective as an instrument or its employment will undercut their political agenda. Therein lies the key to preventing future Pearl Harbors, 9/11s, and October 7ths. While the instant of attack always favors the attackers, if the long-term price to be paid by the attackers is so great that it precludes a replicated attack, and if the world's opprobrium is powerful and close to unanimous, then future attacks will, to use the Wilson Center's language, decline in incidence. Attempts to garner sympathy for the attackers undermine future security. There was little of that after Pearl Harbor. There was more, but still not a lot of it, after 9/11. There is a lot more of it now, particularly on college campuses and within liberal enclaves, as pro-Palestinian marches and demonstrations receive positive media coverage. Remembering Pearl Harbor in 2023 means uniting against the attackers and providing no political cover for the attackers. This has been Colin Hanna for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WRSG-FM in Middleburn, West Virginia, WTUZ-FM in New Philadelphia, Ohio, along with WCRA-AM in Effingham, Illinois. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.